Well, in our last lesson, we saw Jacob, who has not yet been renamed to Israel, to take a wife. Actually, he wound up with two wives, the sisters Leah and Rachel, because his conniving father-in-law, Laban, had deceived him in much the same way Jacob had deceived his own father. Is it not amazing in life that Yahweh often shows us our own sin and the devastating effects it has on others by permitting someone to do to us as we've done to them? Jacob pulled the old switcheroo on his father Isaac because he wanted to ensure that he and not his brother Esau received the best blessing. And as upsetting as this deception was to his father, it embittered Esau for years to come. Now, after working for 7 years for Laban that he might have Rachel for his wife during the wedding ceremony, Laban switches out Leah for Rachel and wakes up to find that he was with Leah, not Rachel, the one he thought he had married. Well, it's near the end of chapter 29, and Jacob became a father for the first time. Now, let me remind you that he was now into his 80s. And the focal point of the last several verses of chapter 29 is about Leah providing sons for Jacob. First Reuben, then Simeon, then Levi, and finally Judah. The chapter ends by telling us that for some unknown reason, Leah's womb dries up. The first several verses of chapter 30 are going to now change gears. Tell us a lot about Rachel and the contrast between Leah, the plain but godly sister, and Rachel, the beautiful but worldly sister, couldn't be more clear. Jacob is still up in Haran of Mesopotamia, and it's interesting that we find that like Abraham, who was born in a land outside of the promised land, so would Jacob's children. The ones who in the future would be called the tribes of Israel, they too began their lives as foreigners. So open your Bibles and let's read Genesis chapter 30. Genesis chapter 30, if you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 31. I'm going to do quite a bit of reading this morning. When Rachel saw that she was not bearing children for Yaakov, for Jacob, she envied her sister and said to Jacob, "Give me children or I'll die." And this made Jacob angry at Rachel, and he answered, "Am I in God's place? He's the one who's denying you children." And she said, "Here is my maid, Bilhah. Go sleep with her and let her give birth to a child that will be laid on my knees so that through her I too can build a family." So she gave him Bilhah, her slave girl, as his wife, and Jacob went in and slept with her, and Bilhah conceived and bore Jacob a son. And Rachel said, "God has judged in my favor. Indeed, he's heard me and given me a son." Therefore, she called him Dan. He judged. Bilhah, Rachel's slave girl, conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. And Rachel said, "I have wrestled mightily with my sister and won," and called him Naphtali, my wrestling. And when Leah saw that she had stopped having her children, she took Zilpah, her slave girl, and gave her to Jacob as his wife. Zilpah, Leah's slave girl, bore Jacob a son, and Leah said, "Good fortune has come," calling him Gad, good fortune. Zilpah, Leah's slave girl, bore Jacob a second son, and Leah said, "How happy I am, and women will say I'm happy." So she called him Asher, happy. And during the wheat harvest season, Reuben went in and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother, Leah. And Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes so that I can be fertile." And she answered, "Isn't it enough that you've taken away my husband? Do you have to take my son's mandrakes too?" And Rachel said, "Very well. In exchange for your son's mandrakes, you sleep with him tonight." And when Jacob came in from the field in the evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, "You have to come in and sleep with me because I've hired you with my son's mandrakes." So Jacob slept with her that night, and God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. And Leah said, God has given me my hire, because I gave my slave girl to my husband. So she called him Issachar, hire, reward. Leah conceived again and bore a sixth son to Jacob. And Leah said, God has given me a wonderful gift. Now at last my husband will live with me, since I've borne him six sons. And she called him Zebulun, living together. And after this, she gave birth to a daughter and named her Dinah. Controversy over rights. And then God took note of Rachel and heeded her prayer and made her fertile. And she conceived and had a son. And God and said, God has taken away my disgrace. She called him Yosef. May he add, saying, may God add to me another son. Well, after Rachel had given birth to Yosef, Yaakov said to Laban, send me on my way so that I can return to my own place, to my own country. Let me take my wives for whom I've served you and my children and let me go. You know very well how faithfully I've served you. And Laban answered him, if you regard me favorably, then please listen. I have observed the signs that Adonai has blessed me on account of you. Name your wages, he said. I'll pay them. Jacob replied, you know how faithfully I have served you and how your livestock have prospered under my care. The few you had before I came have increased substantially. Adonai has blessed you wherever I went. But now, when will I provide for my own household? And Laban said, what should I give you? Nothing, answered Jacob. Just do this one thing for me. Once more I'll pasture your flock and take care of it. I'll also go through the flock. Pick out every speckled, spotted, or brown sheep, every speckled or spotted goat. These and their offspring will be my wages. I will let my integrity stand as witness against me in the future. When you come to look over the animals constituting my wages, every goat that isn't speckled or spotted and every sheep that isn't brown will count as stolen by me. And Laban replied, as you have said it, so be it. That day Laban removed the male goats that were streaked or spotted and all the female goats that were speckled or spotted, every one with white on it, all the brown sheep, and turned them over to his sons and put 3 days' distance between himself and Jacob. Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks. Jacob took fresh-cut branches from poplar, almond, and plane trees and made white streaks on them by peeling off the bark. Then he set the rods he had peeled upright in the watering troughs so that the animals would see them when they came to drink. And since they bred when they came to drink, the animals mated inside of the rods and gave birth to streaked, spotted, speckled young. Jacob divided the lambs and had the animals mate with the streaked and the brown in the flock of Laban. He also kept his own livestock separate. He did not have them mix with Laban's flock. And whenever the hardier animals came into heat, Jacob would set up the rods in the watering trough so that the animals would see them and conceive in front of them. But he didn't set up the rods in front of the weaker animals. Thus, the more feeble were Laban's, the stronger Jacob's. In this way, the man became very rich, had large flocks along with male and female slaves, camels, and donkeys. Well, Rachel, blessed with beauty, a quality for which she couldn't take any credit, the wife who got the lion's share of Jacob's attention is now jealous of the one trait of her sister that, other than for that one trait, made Leah an afterthought in Jacob's life. And that was Leah's ability to have children. Like a small, petty child, Rachel actually blames Jacob for her barrenness. And Jacob replies by telling her pretty firmly that it would appear he is not where the problem lies. So taking a page from her grandmother, Sarah's life, she gets into the act by giving her personal servant girl to Jacob to have children in her stead. Now we see this reference here, as we've seen a few times before, of this servant girl being given to her husband by her mistress as a wife, it says. Now just remember that in reality, the servant girl is what in English we would call a concubine. Her status was indeed elevated from servant by becoming a concubine of Jacob's, but that status did not reach to that of either Leah or Rachel's, who were both legal wives with all the rights and honors and marriage ceremonies that went with the position of legal wife versus concubine wife. Now, this story of Jacob and Leah and Rachel allows me to point something out here that needs to be made clear. God most certainly did not validate Jacob's choice to take two wives any more than he did Isaac's or Abraham's. Too often we like to say, well, it's in the Bible, so God must be okay with it. Not so. Very often, the Holy Scriptures simply tell the historical truth. They tell us what was said, what happened, and then does not specifically comment on it. Rather, these statements stand on their own. God made it quite clear early in Genesis that marriage was the forming of one flesh from two, not three, four, five, or six, as Solomon, so much later, did 1,000. Now, this is why it's so important to read and study the whole Bible, so that we can separate God's commandments and principles and characteristics from simple statements that come from historical fact or from centuries of man-made doctrines. The Bible is full of statements by men and women. Many of those statements are outright lies or self-aggrandizing or greatly exaggerated or wishful thinking or rationalizations of personal behavior or expressions of widely held superstitions. In the case of Jacob, he deceived his brother Esau and his father. It wasn't right. That is not a good model for us just because he did it and it's in the Bible. But he did it, and the Bible straightforwardly reports it. Jacob didn't pick the wife, Leah, on his own, that apparently God had selected for him. He picked the one, Rachel, that most pleased his fleshly and impulsive male desires. It wasn't right, but he did it, and the Scriptures tell us about it, and so on. We must never assume that since the Bible doesn't comment on every statement or action as to whether it's right or wrong, good or evil, that those not commented on must be to some degree acceptable to God. Because if we have the Torah in our hearts and in our minds, and we've read it and we've studied it, we know what is right and wrong in God's eyes, and that is what we are expected to do. The fact that we are given the full, unflinching view of just who these Bible characters were, flaws and all, doesn't change God's absolute, unchanging, uncompromising truth. Like us, just like us, every Bible character, except for Yeshua, was imperfect and did things they ought not to have done. Now let's move on. Rachel gives her servant girl Bilhah to Jacob to bear a child in her stead. Verse 3 says that Rachel gave Bilhah so that she could bear a child on my knees and through her I too have children. That phrase, may bear on my knees, is a Hebrew idiom that is reflective of a long-standing Middle Eastern custom. The custom is that by ceremonially placing a child on one's knees or lap, that person is signifying that they're claiming that child as their own. This is a legal claim. And it is done for reasons, as we see here, where a servant is meant to be used as a surrogate mother for the servant's master, or when a child is being legally adopted. So we have to understand that in the same way Rachel had full right to claim the child that her servant Bilhah will bear, Rachel equally has full right not to accept a child that her servant girl produces. It's her choice. She's not obligated to accept a child that her servant produces, even if that child comes from her own husband's seed. So for all we know, and very likely is the case, Bilhah probably produced some girl babies along the way. And there's no evidence that Rachel accepted them as her own. It would have been great shame on Bilhah if she were not allowed to produce and keep some children for herself. And a servant of this type was well treated and loved and cared for and considered a part of the family. So it's unthinkable that she would not have been permitted to have and raise some children of her own. Now, of course, The purpose of this narrative here in Genesis is to show where the tribes of Israel came from. And so the only pertinent information would be about the sons that were produced, not daughters, although we find one notable exception in the coming chapters. Bilhah, Rachel's servant, now Jacob's concubine, bears him a son in Rachel's name, and her son's name is Dan, which means to judge. Not too long thereafter, she gives him another son, Naphtali, which means wrestling or contest. Now, Leah, who we are told at the end of the last chapter stopped bearing children for some reason, seeing Rachel's successes and its apparent rewards, now allows herself to be infected with these same weak notions. So she gives her servant girl, Zilpah, to Jacob to bear children in her stead. Jacob, his sinful weakness is so readily apparent, just can't seem to do the right thing either. And he accepts Leah's servant girl as another one of his concubines. First, God, good fortune. Then Asher, happy, are born to Zilpah, and they are claimed by Leah as their own. Now, the fact is, there was a bit of a battle going on here between these two sisters. They each wanted to be their husband's favorite, and they each figured they would earn that favoritism by giving him highly valued sons. So a little later, these competitive and superstitious sisters make a deal. Seems that Reuben, Leah's son, goes into the field to gather mandrakes. Now, mandrakes are supposed to be an aphrodisiac. Why would he do that? Because Reuben was well aware that Jacob, his father, would alternate sleeping with his two legal wives, Leah and Rachel. But Leah was still playing second fiddle to Rachel. And of course, that open favoritism bothered Reuben because it greatly bothered his mom, Leah. Now, sex just being a part of life, particularly for children that are raised around herds and flocks, Reuben's just trying to help his mom, who undoubtedly complained to her son about the unfairness of this situation. And he thinks perhaps mandrakes are the answer to his mother's unhappiness. In Hebrew, the word translated as into English as mandrake is dudaim. And while much folklore is attached to the aphrodisiac powers of mandrakes, they were widely used for real, useful medicines. A mandrake bears a small, cherry-like fruit that ripens about the same time as the wheat harvest. It has a very heavy fragrance. Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of love, has a nickname, the Lady of the Mandrake. Now, what's interesting is that since Hebrew is a root word-based language, we find that the word for mandrake, dudaim, is an offshoot of the Hebrew word dodai, which is an alternate word for love. So in the Song of Solomon, for instance, we're going to see a play on those two words, in which it is said, therefore, give my dodai, my love, to you as the dudaim, mandrakes, give off their fragrance. See the connection? But as we're about to see, while the scriptures don't directly say that the use of mandrakes for the purposes Leah and Rachel had in mind are just ridiculous superstition, it does make a point of demonstrating that when we see that the one who gave up the mandrakes, Leah, it is the one who she's the one who produces three more children. Rachel, the one who winds up with the mandrakes, remains barren for a few more years. So Rachel, upon seeing the mandrakes her nephew Reuben has gathered, never even considers her sister Leah's feelings and says, hey, give me some of those. Leah says, yeah, right, so that you can go sleep with my husband. I mean, what do you do here? Well, what must have passed for wisdom between the two of them, Leah gives Rachel the mandrakes in exchange for Rachel agreeing it'll be Leah that sleeps with Jacob that night. I mean, you talk about R-rated. Anyway, Leah gets pregnant, gives birth to Issachar, which means he, God, brings reward. Verse 18 informs us that this confused woman actually decided that Issachar was God's reward to her for having given to Jacob her servant girl as a concubine. I mean, talk about a dysfunctional family. I mean, it makes me feel better about mine just telling you about it. Anyway, Leah goes on to give Jacob another son, Zebulun, meaning dwelling. Why dwelling? Because Leah thought for sure that her childbearing scorecard now outpaced her sister Rachel's. So Jacob would dwell with her in preference to, or even maybe to the exclusion of, her sister Rachel. Next, we have that exception to the rule of the Bible, usually only recording the sons that were born. A girl, Dinah, is born to Leah. And after that, it's Rachel's turn. She gives birth to Joseph, whose name is a very interesting wordplay in the original Hebrew as it's used here in these verses. I want you to take a look at verse 23. Speaking about Rachel, it says that when she gave birth to a son, Rachel announced that God has taken away my disgrace. Taken away my disgrace. The Hebrew word translated as taken away is asaf. In the next verse, verse 24, Rachel goes on to say that she therefore would name him Yosef because the Lord added another son to her. Yosef means to add. Asaf, take away. This was a prophetic name for Joseph because in a few years, Joseph would be taken away from his father. Then many years later, he'd be added back in. It's interesting to note here, as I mentioned at the beginning of the lesson, that all but one of Jacob's sons would be born while he was still in bond servitude to Laban and while he was still living up in Haran of Mesopotamia. So just as the sons of Israel would be born outside of the promised land, so they would be held captive and grow into a nation outside of the promised land in Egypt. 14 years, 7 years for each of his two wives has passed. Jacob is ready to have his bond servitude acknowledged as paid in full by Laban. But the ever crafty, greedy Laban is not ready for Jacob to leave, because he has profited greatly by Jacob's presence. See, Laban is a pagan spiritualist. He believes in the spirit world. He believes there are many gods in this spirit world. He believes that Jacob's God is one of these gods. So in verse 27, Laban invokes Jacob's God. And he says that he has spiritually divined, now divining things of the spiritual world or what psychics and mediums do, so it is Jacob's God that's caused all this great increase in the herds and flocks to occur, which is most certainly true. But Laban is just saying it in hopes Jacob will stay. So here we see two masters of deception, Jacob and Laban, doing battle with one another. Jacob employs the thing he knows best, tending herds and flocks to his advantage against the apparently ignorant Laban. He says he'll stay for a while more if he's given all the speckled and spotted sheep and goats. The clever Jacob convinces Laban. The reason for this is that it makes it easy to identify which animals belong to him, which ones belong to Laban, and to identify the increase, therefore, of those two flocks. In reality, Jacob knows he can make his own flock increase more, and Laban will never be able to cheat him by saying some of those animals are his because the coloring sets them apart. The deal about the sticks that seem to make the animals breed and produce spotted, striped, and speckled offspring has been called by Bible scholars anything from rank superstition up to the ancient way of promoting Mendelian genetic breeding. Now, more is at work here than meets the eye. But these subtleties are automatically disguised by the translation from Hebrew to English, and to other languages for that matter. Notice that the emphasis in these passages is on what? The color of the animals. Specifically, the color of the animals will determine whether the animal belongs to Jacob or to Laban. The gist is that the all-white sheep and the all-dark goats go to Laban, while the goats that had white spots or streaks in their dark hair and the white sheep that had dark spots in their wool, those are to go to Jacob. It must be understood that the sheep of that era were usually pure white, and goats normally dark brown or even black. Implicit is that Laban had a preference for the white animals, sheep. Why? Because white for sheep was the norm, and no spots of dark color normally occurred on sheep. It was the reverse for the goats. They were always dark, only rarely had white spots on them. So if a sheep was all white, it went to Laban, and practically all the sheep were white. Now, in Hebrew, the word for white is Laban. Get it? Jacob's father-in-law's name means white. And all the white animals were to go to Mr. White. Laban's expectation was that the amount of sheep born all white would vastly outnumber those who had dark spots on them, ditto for the amount of dark-colored goats that would greatly outnumber those who had some white spots on them. That the herds of spotted goats and sheep increased as much or more than all the white sheep or the dark goats infuriated Laban, Mr. White. The white spots and white streaks on the goats denote that Jacob got the best of Laban in a very visible way. This was an open insult to Laban, and it would quickly fester into a big problem because it stared him in the face every day. In the end, Jacob grew far superior flocks and herds to Laban's. Jacob became greatly prosperous as a result. The servant had become greater than his master. And this did nothing but exacerbate an already dangerous rift between Laban's clan and Jacob's growing family. Trouble was just over the horizon. Let's move on now to Genesis chapter 31. Genesis chapter 31. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 33. Genesis chapter 31. But then he heard what Laban's sons were saying. Yaakov has taken away everything that our father once had. It's from what used to belong to our father that he's gotten so rich. He also saw that Laban regarded him differently than before. And Adonai said to Jacob, return to the land of your ancestors, to your kinsmen. I'll be with you. So Jacob sent for Rachel and Leah and had them come to the field where his flock was. And he said to them, I see by the way your father looks, he feels differently toward me than before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength, and that your father has belittled me and has changed my wages 10 times. But God did not allow him to do me damage. He said, if he said the speckled will be your wages, then all the animals gave birth to speckled young. And if he said the streaked will be your wages, all the animals gave birth to streaked young. This is how God has taken away your father's animals and given them to me. Once when the animals were mating, I had a dream. I looked up and there in front of me, the male goats which mated with the females were streaked, speckled, and spotted. Then in the dream, the angel of God said to me, Jacob. And I replied, here I am. He continued, raise your eyes now and look. All the male goats mating with the females are streaked, speckled, and mottled, for I have seen everything Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a standing stone with oil, where you vowed your vow to me. Now get up and get out of this land and return to the land where you were born. Rachel and Leah answered him, we no longer have any inheritance from our father's possession. He considers us foreigners since he sold us. Moreover, he's consumed everything he received in exchange for us. Nevertheless, the wealth which God has taken away from our father has become ours and our children's anyway. So whatever God has told you to do, do. Then Jacob got up and put his sons and wives on the camels and carried off all his livestock, all along with the riches he had accumulated, the livestock in his possession which he had acquired in Padan Aram, to go to Isaac his father in the land of Canaan. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep. So Rachel stole the household idols that belonged to her father, and Jacob outwitted Laban the Arami, the Aramite, by not telling him of his intended flight. So he fled with everything he had. He departed, crossed the Euphrates River, and set out for the hill country of Gilead. Not until the third day was Laban told that Jacob had fled. Laban took his kinsmen with him and spent the next 7 days pursuing Jacob, overtaking him in the hill country of Gilead. But God came to Laban, the Aramite, in a dream that night and said to him, "Be careful that you don't say anything to Jacob, either good or bad." And when Laban caught up with Jacob, Jacob had set up camp in the hill country. So Laban and his kinsmen set up camp in the hill country of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, "What do you mean by deceiving me and carrying off my daughters as if they were captives taken in a war? Why did you flee in secret and deceive me and not tell me? I would have sent you off with joy and singing to the music of tambourines and lyres. You didn't even let me kiss my sons and daughters goodbye. What a stupid thing to do. I have it in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night and said, 'Be careful that you don't say anything to Jacob, good or bad. Granted that you had to leave because you long so deeply for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?' And Jacob answered Laban, 'Because I was afraid. I said, suppose you take your daughters away from me by force. But if you find your gods with someone, that person won't remain alive. So with our kinsmen to witness, if you spot anything that I have which belongs to you, take it back.' And Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. And Laban went into Jacob's tent and then into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two slave girls. He didn't find them. He left Leah's tent and he entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the saddle of the camel she was riding, and she was sitting on them. Laban felt all around the tent. He didn't find them. And she said to her father, 'Please don't be angry that I'm not getting up in your presence, but it's the time of my period.' So he searched. He didn't find the household gods. Then Jacob became angry and he started arguing with Laban. 'What have I done wrong?' he demanded. 'What is my offense that you've come after me in hot pursuit? You have felt all around in my stuff. What have you found of all your household gods? Put it here. Put it in front of my kinsmen and yours so that they can render judgment between the two of us. I've been with you for 20 years. Your female sheep and goats haven't aborted their young. I haven't eaten the male animals of your flocks. If one of your flock was destroyed by a wild animal, I didn't bring the carcass to you. I bore the loss myself. You demanded that I compensate you for any animal stolen, whether by day or night. Here's how it was for me. During the day, thirst consumed me. At night, the cold. My sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years, I've been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters, 6 years for your flock. You changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the one whom Isaac fears, had not been on my side, by now you would have certainly already sent me away with nothing. God has seen how distressed I've been, how hard I've worked. Last night he passed judgment in my favor." Laban answered Jacob, "The daughters are mine, the children are mine, the flocks are mine, everything you see is mine. But what can I do today about these daughters of mine or the children they have borne? So now come, let's make a covenant, I and you. Let it stand as a testimony between you, me and you." And Jacob took a stone and he set it upright as a standing stone. And then Jacob said to his kinsmen, "Gather some stones." And they took stones and made a pile of them and ate there by the pile of stones. Laban called it Yegar Sahudata, pile of witnesses in Aramaic, while Jacob called it Galed, pile of witnesses in Hebrew. And Laban said, "This pile of witnesses between me and you today, this is why it is called Galed, and also Ha Mitzpah, the watchtower. Because he said, 'May God watch between me and you when we are apart from each other. If you cause pain to my daughters, or if you take wives in addition to my daughters, then even if no one is there with us, still God is witness between me and you.'" Laban also said to Yaakov, "Here is this pile and here is this standing stone which I have set up between me and you. May this pile be a witness, may the standing stone be a witness, that I will not pass beyond this pile to you, and you will not pass beyond this pile and this standing stone to me to cause harm. May the God of Abraham and also the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. But Jacob swore by the one his father Isaac feared. Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and invited his kinsmen to the meal. They ate the food and spent the whole night on the mountain. Well, here we witness history repeat itself. Jacob had a life in many ways similar to Abraham. He was a man without a country, a wanderer. Did he belong to Mesopotamia? Did he belong to the land of Canaan? We're also reminded of the situation between Lot and Abraham when Lot's wealth grew so large that it caused a tension between those loyal to Abraham and those loyal to Lot. So the only situation was a separation. Jacob and Laban now find themselves in that same situation. It is rare in the Bible that we find division and separation occurring on happy terms. Something unpleasant was usually at the heart of the matter to cause it. So perhaps we should take heart. The divisions and separations that have happened in our own lives are resulting from maybe bad judgment, selfishness, sin, even something completely out of our control. It's normal. It's normal for life. It is a Christian cliche that God uses imperfect people to bring about his perfect will. In reality, what other kind of people are there than imperfect for him to work with? And just as Lot cut ties permanently with Abraham and went on to form a new and separate family line that would result in nations of Moab and Ammon, here we find that Jacob will, due to the circumstances that Jehovah uses to achieve his purposes, finally cut family ties with the land of Mesopotamia and his in-laws. Now, although Jacob will eventually lead his family to Egypt for the purpose of survival, it's now clear that the land of Canaan is home and no other. Well, in verse 1, Jacob overhears Laban's sons grumbling about how Jacob's herds and flocks really ought to be theirs. Man, I mean, the apple didn't fall very far from the tree, did it? Laban's sons are just like him, jealous and selfish and greedy. And when the ever-observant Jacob notices this distinct change in the demeanor of Laban's family, he knows it's time to leave. That notion is verified by God, who instructs Jacob that now's the time that he should fulfill his promise to bring Jacob back to his home in Canaan. Jacob consults with his wives. Man, they're more than ready to leave. In fact, here they reveal their hurt and anger with their father, Laban, because in their eyes, he had shown them the greatest disrespect by virtually selling them to Jacob instead of following the usual betrothal customs. I also want to point out something else here. There can be no doubt that Hebrew society was male-dominated. However, Hebrew society greatly revered women, and any notion that the Bible promotes the idea that women were then or are now of less value than men is just uninformed. Notice here that the Holy Scriptures show the first thing Jacob did after God told him it was time to leave was what? He consulted with his wives. First thing he did. And it's obvious by the way they responded that Jacob greatly considered their feelings and their thoughts on the matter. It's not that Jacob didn't lead. It's that he included his wives in a decision that greatly affected them, leaving their family forever. Jacob plans their escape. He executes it. He puts his family on camels. He separates his property from Laban's. And in an opportune moment, while Laban is off shearing some sheep, they leave, but not before Rachel steals her father's set of household gods to take with her on this journey. Why would she do that? The verses just before this answer that question. In verse 14, the two sisters said to Jacob, "Do we still have any portion or inheritance in our father's house?" See, this was more than a rhetorical question. In other words, they knew full well their father had no intention of caring for them. Even more, this is an indication that they are breaking allegiance with their father, because in verse 16, they say, "All that Jacob's God took from Laban now belongs to us and our children." In Mesopotamia, it was the tradition that he who possessed the family gods was the owner of the family wealth and authority. By Rachel stealing these gods, it was her intent to assure a family inheritance. Remember, that was her concern just a couple of verses ago. An inheritance for herself after her father died. Apparently, she planned on keeping them until her father Laban went to the grave, and then appearing before her family with what amounted to the will, even the keys to the safety deposit box. And then, of course, the right to be the executor of the estate, all rolled into one. This was a very serious matter. This went way above any kind of petty theft or retribution. But even more, Laban and his family, and likely Rachel as well, they all believed that those idols were real, that they actually represented real gods. And those who adhered to this system prayed to these idols for rain, for healing, for children, for protection, and so on. Without his household gods, in Laban's mind, he was in a fix. We're going to see how the story progresses next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seed of Abraham Fellowship.